CD 2.
Chocolat by Joanne Harris. Sunday, February the 16th. My mother was a witch. At least that's what she called herself, falling so many times into the game of believing herself that at the end there was no telling fake from fact. Armand Voisin reminds me of her in some ways. The bright, wicked eyes, the long hair, which must have been glossy black in her youth, the blend of wistfulness and cynicism. From her I learned what shaped me, the art of turning bad luck into good, the forking of the fingers to divert the path of malchance, the sewing of a sachet, brewing of a draught, the conviction that a spider brings good luck before midnight and bad luck after. Most of all, she gave me her love of new places, the gypsy wanderlust which took us all over Europe and further. A year in Budapest, another in Prague, 6 months in Rome, 4 in Athens, then across the Alps to Monaco, along the coast, Cannes, Marseille, Barcelona. By my 18th year I had lost count of the cities in which we had lived, the languages we had spoken. Jobs were as varied: waitressing, interpreting, car repair. Sometimes we escaped from the windows of cheap overnight hotels without paying the bill. We rode trains without tickets, forged work permits, crossed borders illicitly. We were deported countless times. Twice my mother was arrested, but released without charge. Our names changed as we moved, drifting from one regional variant to another. Jan, Jeanne, Johann, Giovanna, Anne, Anushka. Like thieves, we were perpetually on the run, converting the unwieldy ballast of life into francs, pounds, krona, dollars, as we fled where the wind took us. Don't think I suffered. Life was a fine adventure for those years. We had each other, my mother and I. I never felt the need for a father. My friends were countless. And yet it must have preyed upon her sometimes, the lack of permanence, the need always to contrive. Still, we raced faster as the years wore on, staying a month, two at the most, then moving on like fugitives racing the sunset. It took me some years to understand that it was death we fled. She was 40. It was cancer. She'd known for some time, she told me, but recently, no, there was to be no hospital. No hospital, did I understand? There were months, years left in her, and she wanted to see America, New York, the Florida Everglades. We were moving almost every day now, mother reading the cards at night when she thought I was asleep. We boarded a cruiser from Lisbon, both of us working in the kitchens. Finishing at 2 or 3 every morning, we rose at dawn. Every night the cards, slippery to the touch with age and respectful handling, were laid out on the bunk beside her. She whispered their names to herself, sinking deeper every day into the mazy confusion which would eventually claim her altogether. 10 of swords, death. 3 of swords, death. 2 of swords, death. The chariot, death. The chariot turned out to be a New York cab one summer evening as we shopped for groceries in the busy Chinatown streets. It was better than cancer, in any case. When my daughter was born, 9 months later, I called her after both of us. It seemed appropriate. Her father never knew her, nor am I sure which one he was in the wilting daisy chain of my brief encounters. It doesn't matter. I could have peeled an apple at midnight and thrown the rind over my shoulder to know his initial, but I never cared enough to do it. Too much ballast slows us down. And yet, since I left New York, haven't the winds blown less hard, less often? Hasn't there been a kind of wrench every time we leave a place, a kind of regret? I think there has. 25 years, and at last the spring has begun to grow tired, just as my mother grew tired in the final years. I find myself looking at the sun and wondering what it would be like to see it rise above the same horizon for 5, maybe 10, maybe 20 years. The thought fills me with a strange dizziness, a feeling of fear and longing. And Anouk, my little stranger? I see the brave adventure we lived for so long in a different light now that I am the mother. I see myself as I was, the brown girl with the long, uncombed hair, wearing cast-off charity shop clothing, learning maths the hard way, geography the hard way. How much bread for 2 francs? How far will a 50-mark rail ticket take us? And I do not want it for her. Perhaps this is why we have stayed in France for the last 5 years. For the first time in my life, I have a bank account. I have a trade. My mother would have despised all this, and yet perhaps she would have envied me too. Forget yourself if you can, she would have told me. Forget who you are, for as long as you can bear it. But one day, my girl, one day it will catch you. I know. I opened as usual today. For the morning only, I'll allow myself a half day with Anouk this afternoon. But it's mass this morning, and there'll be people in the square. February has reasserted its drab self, and now it is raining, a freezing, gritty rain which slicks the paving and colours the sky the shade of old pewter. Anouk reads a book of nursery rhymes behind the counter, and keeps an eye on the door for me as I prepare a batch of mondiant in the kitchen. These are my own favourites, thus named because they were sold by beggars and gypsies years ago. Biscuit-sized discs of dark milk or white chocolate, upon which have been scattered lemon rind, almonds, and plump Malaga raisins. Anouk likes the white ones, though I prefer the dark, made with the finest 70% couverture. Bitter smooth on the tongue, with the taste of the secret tropics. My mother would have despised this, too. And yet this is also a kind of magic. Since Friday I have fitted a set of bar stools next to the counter of La Praline. Now it looks a little like the diners we used to visit in New York. Red leather seats and chrome stems, cheerily kitsch. The walls are a bright daffodil colour. Poitou's old orange armchair lolls cheerily in one corner. A menu stands to the left, hand-lettered and coloured by Anouk in shades of orange and red. Chocolat chaud, 10 francs. Chocolat espresso, 15 francs. Chococino, 12 francs. Mocha, 12 francs. I baked the cake last night, and the hot chocolate is standing in a pot on the hob, awaiting my first customer. I make sure that a similar menu is visible from the window, and I wait. Mass comes and goes. I watch the passers-by, morose beneath the freezing drizzle. My door, slightly open, emits a hot scent of baking and sweetness. I catch a number of longing glances at the source of this, but a flick of the eye backwards, a shrugging of the shoulders, a twist of the mouth which may be resolve or simply temper, and they are gone, leaning into the wind with rounded, miserable shoulders, as if an angel with a flaming sword were standing at the door to bar their entry. Time, I tell myself. This kind of thing takes time. But all the same, a kind of impatience, almost anger, penetrates me. What is wrong with these people? Why do they not come? 10 o'clock sounds, then 11. I can see people going into the bakery opposite and coming out again with loaves tucked under their arms. The rain stops, though the sky remains grim. 11:30. The few people who still linger in the square turn homewards to prepare the Sunday meal. A boy with a dog skirts the corner of the church, carefully avoiding the dripping guttering. He walks past with barely a glance. Damn them. Just when I thought I was beginning to get through. Why do they not come? Can they not see, not smell? What else do I have to do? Anouk, always sensitive to my moods, comes to hug me. Maman, don't cry. I'm not crying. I never cry. Her hair tickles my face, and I feel suddenly dizzy with the fear that one day I might lose her. It isn't your fault. We tried. We did everything right. True enough. Even to the red ribbons around the door, the sachets of cedar and lavender to repel bad influences. I kiss her head. There is moisture on my face. Something, perhaps the bittersweet aroma of the chocolate vapor, stings my eyes. It's all right, chérie. What they do shouldn't affect us. We can at least have a drink to cheer ourselves up. We perch on our stools like New York barflies, a cup of chocolate each. Anouk has hers with crème chantilly and chocolate curls. I drink mine hot and black, stronger than espresso. We close our eyes in the fragrant steam and see them coming. Two, three, a dozen at a time. Their faces lighting up, sitting beside us, their hard, indifferent faces melting into expressions of welcome and delight. I open my eyes quickly, and Anouk is standing by the door. For a second I can see Pantoufle, perched on her shoulder, whiskers twitching. The light behind her seems warmer somehow, altered, alluring. I jump to my feet. Please, don't do that. She gives me one of her darkling glances. I was only trying to help. Please. For a second she faces me out, her face set stubbornly. Glamours swim between us like golden smoke. It would be so easy, she tells me with her eyes, so easy, like invisible fingers stroking, inaudible voices coaxing the people in. We can't. We shouldn't. I try to explain to her. It sets us apart. It makes us different. If we are to stay, we must be as like them as possible. Pantoufle looks up at me in appeal, a whiskery blur against the golden shadows. Deliberately I close my eyes against him, and when I open them again he is gone. It's all right, I tell Anouk firmly. We'll be all right. We can wait. And finally, at 12:30, someone comes. Anouk saw him first. Maman? But I was on my feet at once. It was Renaud, one hand shielding his face from the dripping canvas of the awning, the other hesitating at the door handle. His pale face was serene, but there was something in his eyes, a furtive satisfaction. I somehow understood he was not a customer. The bell jangled as he entered, but he did not walk up to the counter. Instead, he remained in the doorway, the wind blowing the folds of his soutane into the shop like the wings of a black bird. Monsieur? I saw him eye the red ribbons with mistrust. Can I help you? I'm sure I know your favorites. I lapsed into my sales banter automatically, but it is untrue. I have no idea of this man's tastes. He is a complete blank to me. A man-shaped darkness cut into the air. I feel no point of contact with him, and my smile broke on him like a wave on a rock. Renaud gave me a narrow look of contempt. I doubt that. His voice was low and pleasant, but I sensed dislike behind the professional tones. I recalled Armand Voisin's words. I hear our Monsieur le Curé has it in for you already. Why? An instinctive mistrust of unbelievers? Or can there be more? Beneath the counter I forked my fingers at him in secret. I wasn't expecting you to be open today. He is more sure of himself now he thinks he knows us. His small, tight smile is like an oyster, milky white at the edges and sharp as a razor. On a Sunday, you mean? I was at my most innocent. I thought I might catch the rush at the end of Mass. The tiny jibe failed to sting him. On the first Sunday of Lent. He sounded amused, but beneath the amusement there was disdain. I shouldn't think so. Lansquenet folk are simple folk, Madame Rocher, he told me. Devout folk. He stressed the word, gently, politely. It's Mademoiselle Rocher. Small victory, but enough to break his stride. His eyes flicked towards Anouk, who was still sitting at the counter with the tall chocolate glass in one hand. Her mouth was smeared with frothy chocolate, and I felt it again like the sudden sting of a concealed nettle, the panic, the irrational terror of losing her. But to whom? I shook the thought with growing anger. To him? Let him try. Of course, he replied smoothly. Mademoiselle Rocher, I do apologize. I smiled sweetly at his disapproval. Something in me continued to court it, perversely. My voice, a shade too loud, took on a ring of vulgar self-confidence to hide my fear. It's so nice to meet someone in these rural parts who understands. I flashed him my hardest, brightest smile. I mean, in the city where we used to live, no one gave us a thought, but here, I managed to look contrite and unrepentant at the same time. I mean, it's absolutely lovely here, and the people have been so helpful, so quaint, but it isn't Paris, is it? Renaud agreed, with the tiniest of sneers, that it wasn't. It's quite true what they say about village communities, I went on. Everyone wants to know your business. I expect it comes of having so little entertainment, I explained kindly. Three shops and a church, I mean. I broke off with a giggle. But of course you know all that. Renaud nodded gravely. Perhaps you could explain to me, mademoiselle. Oh, do call me Vianne, I interrupted. Why you decided to move to Lansquenet? His tone was silken with dislike, his thin mouth more like a closed oyster than ever. As you say, it's a little different to Paris. His eyes made it clear that it was a difference entirely in Lansquenet's favour. A boutique like this. An elegant hand indicated the shop and its contents with languid indifference. Surely such a specialist shop would be more successful, more appropriate in a city. I'm sure that in Toulouse, or even Agen. I knew now why no customers had dared to come this morning. That word, appropriate, held all the glacial condemnation of a prophet's curse. I forked at him again, savagely, under the counter. Renaud slapped at the back of his neck as if an insect had stung him there. I don't think the cities have the franchise on enjoyment, I snapped. Everyone needs a little luxury, a little self-indulgence from time to time. Renaud did not reply. I suppose he disagreed. I said as much. I expect you preached exactly the opposite doctrine in your sermon this morning, I ventured boldly. Then, as he still did not answer, still I'm sure there's room enough in this town for both of us. Free enterprise, isn't that right? Looking at his expression, I could see he understood the challenge. For a moment I held his gaze, making myself brazen, hateful. Renaud flinched back from my smile, as if I had spat in his face. Softly, of course. Oh, I know his type. We saw them enough, mother and I, on our chase around Europe. The same polite smiles, the disdain, the indifference. A small coin dropped from the plump hand of a woman outside Reims' crowded cathedral. Admonishing looks from a group of nuns as a young Vianne leaps to grab it, bare knees scuffing the dusty floor. A black-frocked man in angry, earnest conversation with my mother, she running white-faced from the shadow of the church, squeezing my hand until it hurt. Later I learned she had tried to confess to him. What prompted her to do it? Loneliness, perhaps. The need to talk, to confide in someone who was not a lover. Someone with an understanding face. But didn't she see? His face, now not so understanding, contorted in angry frustration. It was sin, mortal sin. She should leave the child in the care of good people. If she loved little, what was her name, Anne? If she loved her, she must make this sacrifice. He knew a convent where she could be cared for. He took her hand, crushing her fingers. Didn't she love her child? Didn't she want to be saved? Didn't she? That night my mother wept, rocking me to and fro in her arms. We left Reims in the morning, more like thieves than ever, she carrying me close like stolen treasure, her eyes hot and furtive. I understood he had almost convinced her to leave me behind. After that, she had often asked me if I was happy with her, whether I missed having friends, a home. But however often I told her yes, no, no, however often I kissed her and said I regretted nothing, nothing, a little of the poison remained. For years we ran from the priest, the black man, and when his face returned time and again in the cards, it would be time to run once more, time to hide from the darkness he had opened in her heart. And here he is again, just as I thought we had found our place at last, Anouk and I, standing at the door, like the angel at the gate. Well, this time I swear I will not run, whatever he does, however he turns the people of this place against me. His face is as smooth and certain as the turn of an evil card, and he has declared himself my enemy and I his, as clear as if we had both spoken aloud. I'm so glad we understand each other. My voice is bright and cold. And I. Something in his eyes, some light, where there was none before, alerts me. Amazingly, he is enjoying this closing of two enemies for battle. Nowhere in his armoured certainty is there room for the thought that he might not win. He turns to go, very correct, with just the right inclination of the head, just so, polite contempt, the barbed and poisonous weapon of the righteous. Monsieur le Curé! For a second he turns back, and I press a small beribboned packet into his hands. For you, on the house. My smile brooks no refusal, and he takes the packet with bemused embarrassment. My pleasure. He frowns slightly, as if the thought of my pleasure pains him. But I don't really like... Nonsense. The tone is brisk, unanswerable. I'm sure you'll like these. They just remind me so much of you. Behind his calm exterior, I think he looks startled. Then he is gone, the little packet white in his hand, into the grey rain. I notice that he does not run for shelter, but walks with the same measured tread, not indifferent, but with the look of one who relishes even that small discomfort. I like to think he will eat the chocolates. More probably he will give them away, but I like to think he will at least open them and look. Surely he can spare one glance for the sake of curiosity. They remind me so much of you. A dozen of my best huîtres de Saint-Malo, those small flat pralines, shaped to look like tightly closed oysters. Tuesday, February the 18th. 15 customers yesterday. Today, 34. Guillaume was among them. He bought a cornet of Florentines and a cup of chocolate. Charlie was with him, curling obediently beneath a stool, while from time to time Guillaume dropped a piece of brown sugar into his expectant, insatiable jaws. It takes time, Guillaume tells me, for a newcomer to be accepted in Lansquenet. Last Sunday, he says, Curé Renaud preached such a virulent sermon on the topic of abstinence that the opening of La Céleste Praline that very morning had seemed a direct affront against the church. Caroline Clermont, who is beginning another of her diets, was especially cutting, saying loudly to her friends in the congregation that it was quite shocking, just like stories of Roman decadence, my dears, and if that woman thinks she can just shimmy into town like the Queen of Sheba, disgusting the way she flaunts that illegitimate child of hers, as if, oh, the chocolates, nothing special, my dears, and far too pricey. The general conclusion amongst the ladies was that it, whatever it was, wouldn't last. I would be out of town within a fortnight. And yet the number of my customers has doubled since yesterday, amongst them a number of Madame Clermont's cronies, bright-eyed, if a little shameful, telling each other it was curiosity, that was all, that all they wanted was to see for themselves. I know all their favourites. It's a knack, a professional secret, like a fortune-teller reading palms. My mother would have laughed at this waste of my skills, but I have no desire to probe further into their lives than this. I do not want their secrets or their innermost thoughts, nor do I want their fears or gratitude. A tame alchemist, she would have called me with kindly contempt, working domestic magic when I could have wielded marvels. But I like these people. I like their small and introverted concerns. I can read their eyes, their mouths, so easily. This one with its hint of bitterness will relish my zesty orange twists. This sweet, smiling one, the soft-scented apricot hearts. This girl with the wind-blown hair will love the Mondrian. This brisk, cheery woman, the chocolate Brazils. For Guillaume, the Florentines, eaten neatly over a saucer in his tidy bachelor's house. Narcissi's appetite for double chocolate truffles reveals the gentle heart beneath the gruff exterior. Caroline Clermont will dream of cinder toffee tonight and wake hungry and irritable. And the children, chocolate curls, white buttons with coloured vermicelli, pain de pice with gilded edging, marzipan fruits in their nests of ruffled paper, peanut brittle, clusters, cracknels, assorted misshapes in half-kilo boxes. I sell dreams, small comforts, sweet, harmless temptations to bring down a multitude of saints crash, crash, crashing amongst the hazels and nougatines. Is that so bad? Curé Renaud thinks so, apparently. Here, Charlie. Here, boy. Guillaume's voice is warm when he speaks to his dog, but always a little sad. He bought the animal when his father died, he tells me. That was 18 years ago. But a dog's life is shorter than a man's, and they grew old together. It's here. He brings my attention to a growth under Charlie's chin. It is about the size of a hen's egg, gnarled like an elm burr. It's growing. A pause during which the dog stretches luxuriously, one leg pedalling as his master scratches his belly. The vet says there's nothing to be done. I begin to understand the look of guilt and love I see in Guillaume's eyes. You wouldn't put an old man to sleep, he tells me earnestly, not if he still had, he struggles for words, some quality of life. Charlie doesn't suffer. Not really. I nod, aware he is trying to convince himself. The drugs keep it under control. For the moment. The words ring out unspoken. When the time comes, I'll know. His eyes are soft and horrified. I'll know what to do. I won't be afraid. I top up his chocolate glass without a word and sprinkle the froth with cocoa powder. But Guillaume is too busy with his dog to see. Charlie rolls onto his back, head lolling. Monsieur le curé says animals don't have souls, says Guillaume softly. He says I should put Charlie out of his misery. Everything has a soul, I answer. Well, that's what my mother used to tell me. Everything. He nods, alone in his circle of fear and guilt. What would I do without him? He asks, face still turned towards the dog, and I understand he has forgotten my presence. What would I do without you? Behind the counter, I clench my fist in silent rage. I know that look. Fear, guilt, covetousness. I know it well. It is the look on my mother's face the night of the black man. His words, "What would I do without you?" are the words she whispered to me all through that miserable night. As I glance into my mirror last thing in the evening, as I awake with the growing fear, knowledge, certainty, that my own daughter is slipping away from me, that I am losing her, that I will lose her if I do not find the place, it is the look on my own. I put my arms around Guillaume. For a second he tenses, unused to female contact. Then he relaxes. I can feel the strength of his distress coming from him in waves. Vianne, he says softly. Vianne. It's all right to feel this way, I tell him firmly. It's allowed. Beneath us, Charlie barks his indignation. We made close to 300 francs today, for the first time enough to break even. I told Anouk when she came home from school, but she looked distracted, her bright face unusually still. Her eyes were heavy, dark as the cloud line of an oncoming storm. I asked her what was wrong. "It's Jeannot." Her voice was toneless. "His mother says he can't play with me any more." I remembered Jeannot as Wolfsuit in the Mardi Gras carnival, a lanky 7-year-old with shaggy hair and a suspicious expression. He and Anouk played together in the square last night, running and shouting arcane war cries until the light failed. His mother is Jolene Drew, one of the two primary teachers, a crony of Caroline Clermont. "Oh?" Neutrally. "What does she say?" "She says I'm a bad influence." She flicked a dark glance at me. "Because we don't go to church. Because you opened on Sunday."
"You opened on Sunday."
I looked at her. I wanted to take her in my arms, but her rigid, hostile stance alarmed me. I made my voice very calm. "And what does Jeannot think?" I asked gently. "He can't do anything. She's always there, watching." Anouk's voice rose shrilly, and I guessed she was close to tears. "Why does this always have to happen?" she demanded. "Why don't I ever—" She broke off with an effort, her thin chest hitching. "You have other friends?" It was true. There had been 4 or 5 of them last night, the square ringing with their catcalls and laughter. "Jeannot's friends." I saw what she meant. Louis Clermont, Lise Poitou, his friends. Without Jeannot, the group would soon disperse. I felt a sudden pang for my daughter, surrounding herself with invisible friends to people the spaces around her. Selfish, to imagine that a mother could fill that space completely. Selfish and blind. "We could go to church if that's what you want." My voice was gentle. "But you know it wouldn't change anything." Accusing. "Why not? They don't believe. They don't care about God. They just go." I smiled then, not without some bitterness. 6 years old and she still manages to surprise me with the depth of her occasional perception. "That may be true," I said. "But do you want to be like that?" A shrug, cynical and indifferent. She shifted her weight from one foot to the other, as if in fear of a lecture. I searched for the words to explain. But all I could think of was the image of my mother's stricken face as she rocked me and murmured almost fiercely, "What would I do without you? What would I do?" Oh, I taught her all of this long ago. The hypocrisy of the church, the witch hunts, the persecution of travellers and people of other faiths. She understands. But the knowledge does not transpose well to everyday life, to the reality of loneliness, to the loss of a friend. "It's not fair." Her voice was still rebellious, the hostility subdued, but not entirely. Neither was the sack of the Holy Land, nor the burning of Joan of Arc, nor the Spanish Inquisition. But I knew better than to say so. Her features were pinched, intense, any sign of weakness, and she would have turned on me. "You'll find other friends." A weak and comfortless answer. Anouk looked at me with disdain. "But I wanted this one." Her tone was strangely adult, strangely weary as she turned away. Tears swelled her eyelids, but she made no move to come to me for comfort. With a sudden overwhelming clarity, I saw her then, the child, the adolescent, the adult, the stranger she would one day become. And I almost cried out in loss and terror, as if our positions had somehow been reversed, she the adult, I the child. "Please, what would I do without you?" But I let her go without a word, aching to hold her, but too aware of the wall of privacy slamming down between us. Children are born wild, I know. The best I can hope for is a little tenderness, a seeming docility. Beneath the surface, the wildness remains, stark, savage, and alien. She remained virtually silent for the rest of the evening. When I put her to bed, she refused her story, but stayed awake for hours after I had put out my own light. I heard her from the darkness of my room, walking to and fro, occasionally talking to herself, or to Pantoufle, in fierce staccato bursts, too low for me to hear. Much later, when I was sure she was asleep, I crept into her room to switch off the light, and found her curled at the end of her bed, one arm flung wide, head turned at an awkward but absurdly touching angle that tore at my heart. In one hand she clutched a small plasticine figure. I removed it as I straightened the bedclothes, meaning to return it to Anouk's toy box. It was still warm from her hand, releasing an unmistakable scent of primary school, of secrets whispered, of poster paint and newsprint, and half-forgotten friends. 6 inches long, a stick figure painstakingly rendered, eyes and mouth scratched on with a pin, red thread wound about the waist, and something, twigs or dried grass, stuck into the scalp to suggest shaggy brown hair. There was a letter scratched into the plasticine boy's body, just above the heart, a neat capital J. Beneath it, and just close enough to overlap, a letter A. I replaced the figure softly on the pillow beside her head and left, putting out the light. Sometime before dawn she crept into bed with me, as she often had when she was a child, and through soft layers of sleep I heard her whisper, "It's all right, Maman. I'll never leave you." She smelt of salt and baby soap, her hug fierce and warm in the enclosing dark. I rocked her, rocked myself in sweetness, hugged us both in relief so intense that it was almost pain. "I love you, Maman. I'll always love you forever. Don't cry." I wasn't crying. I never cry. I slept poorly inside a kaleidoscope of dreams. Awoke at dawn with Anouk's arm across my face and a dreadful panicky urge to run, to take Anouk and keep on running. How can we live here? How could we have been foolish enough to think he wouldn't find us even here? The black man has many faces, all of them unforgiving, hard, and strangely envious. Run, Vianne, run, Anouk. Forget your small, sweet dream and run. But not this time. We have run too far already, Anouk and I, mother and I, too far from ourselves. This is one dream I meant to cling to. Wednesday, February the 19th. This is our rest day. School is closed, and while Anouk plays by Les Marauds, I will receive the delivery and work on this week's batch of items. This is an art I can enjoy. There is a kind of sorcery in all cooking, in the choosing of ingredients, the process of mixing, grating, melting, infusing, and flavouring, the recipes taken from ancient books, the traditional utensils, the pestle and mortar with which my mother made her incense turned to a more homely purpose, her spices and aromatics giving up their subtleties to a baser, more sensual magic. And it is partly the transience of it that delights me. So much loving preparation, so much art and experience put into a pleasure which can only last a moment, and which only a few will ever fully appreciate. My mother always viewed my interest with indulgent contempt. To her, food was no pleasure, but a tiresome necessity to be worried over, a tax on the price of our freedom. I stole menus from restaurants and looked longingly into patisserie windows. I must have been 10 years old, maybe older, before I first tasted real chocolate. But still the fascination endured. I carried recipes in my head like maps. all kinds of recipes, torn from abandoned magazines in busy railway stations, wheedled from people on the road, strange marriages of my own confection. Mother had her cards, her divinations directed our mad course across Europe. Cookery cards anchored us, placed landmarks on the bleak borders. Paris smells of baking bread and croissant, Marseille of bouillabaisse and grilled garlic. Berlin was eyebrow with sauerkraut and kartoffel salad. Rome was the ice cream I ate without paying in a tiny restaurant beside the river. Mother had no time for landmarks. All her maps were inside, all places the same. Even then we were different. Oh, she taught me what she could, how to see to the core of things, of people, to see their thoughts, their longings. The driver who stopped to give us a lift, who drove 10 kilometres out of his way to take us to Lyon. The grocers who refused payment, the policeman who turned a blind eye. Not every time, of course. Sometimes it failed, for no reason we could understand. Some people are unreadable, unreachable. Francis Reynaud is one of these. And even when it did not, the casual intrusion disturbed me. It was all too easy. Now, making chocolate is a different matter. Oh, some skill is required, a certain lightness of touch, speed, a patience my mother would never have had. But the formula remains the same every time. It is safe, harmless. And I do not have to look into their hearts and take what I need. These are wishes which can be granted simply for the asking. Guy, my confectioner, has known me for a long time. We worked together when Anouk was born, and he helped me to start my first business, a tiny pâtisserie chocolaterie in the outskirts of Nice. Now he is based in Marseille, importing the raw chocolate liquor, direct from South America, and converting it to chocolate of various grades in his factory. I only use the best. The blocks of couverture are slightly larger than house bricks, one box of each per delivery, and I use all three types, the dark, the milk, and the white. It has to be tempered to bring it to its crystalline state, ensuring a hard, brittle surface and a good shine. Some confectioners buy their supplies already tempered, but I like to do it myself. There is an endless fascination in handling the raw, dullish blocks of couverture, in grating them by hand, I never use electric mixers, into the large ceramic pans, then melting, stirring, testing each painstaking step with the sugar thermometer until just the right amount of heat has been applied to make the change. There is a kind of alchemy in the transformation of base chocolate into this wise fool's gold, a layman's magic which even my mother might have relished. As I work, I clear my mind, breathing deeply. The windows are open, and the through draught would be cold if it were not for the heat of the stoves, the copper pans, the rising vapour from the melting couverture. The mingled scents of chocolate, vanilla, heated copper and cinnamon are intoxicating, powerfully suggestive. The raw and earthy tang of the Americas, the hot and resinous perfume of the rainforest. This is how I travel now, as the Aztecs did in their sacred rituals. Mexico, Venezuela, Colombia, the court of Montezuma, Cortez and Columbus, the food of the gods bubbling and frothing in ceremonial goblets, the bitter elixir of life. Perhaps this is what Reno senses in my little shop. A throwback to times when the world was a wider, wilder place. Before Christ, before Adonis was born in Bethlehem or Osiris sacrificed at Easter, the cocoa bean was revered. Magical properties were attributed to it. Its brew was sipped on the steps of sacrificial temples. Its ecstasies were fierce and terrible. Is this what he fears? Corruption by pleasure, the subtle transubstantiation of the flesh into a vessel for debauch. Not for him the orgies of the Aztec priesthood. And yet, in the vapours of the melting chocolate, something begins to coalesce. A vision, my mother would have said. A smoky finger of perception which points... points... there. For a second, I almost had it. Across the glossy surface, a vaporous ripple forms, then another, filmy and pale, half-hiding, half-revealing. For a moment, I almost saw the answer, the secret which he hides, even from himself, with such fearful calculation, the key which will set all of us into motion. Scrying with chocolate is a difficult business. The visions are unclear, troubled by rising perfumes which cloud the mind. And I am not my mother, who retained until the day of her death a power of augury so great that the two of us ran before it in wild and growing disarray. But before the vision dissipates, I am sure I see something. A room, a bed, an old man lying on the bed, his eyes raw holes in his white face. And fire. Fire. Is this what I was meant to see? Is this the black man's secret? I need to know his secret if we are to stay here. And I do need to stay, whatever it takes. Wednesday, February the 19th. A week, mon père. That's all it's been, 1 week. But it seems longer. Why she should disturb me so is beyond me. It's clear what she is. I went to see her the other day to reason with her about her Sunday morning opening time. The place is transformed, the air perfumed with bewildering scents of ginger and spices. I tried not to look at the shelves of sweets, boxes, ribbons, bows in pastel colours, sugared almonds in gold-silver drifts, sugared violets and chocolate rose leaves. There is more than a suspicion of the boudoir about the place, an intimate look, a scent of rose and vanilla. My mother's room had just such a look, all crepe and gauze and cut glass twinkling in the muted light. The ranks of bottles and jars on her dressing table, an army of genies awaiting release. There is something unwholesome about such a concentration of sweetness. A promise half fulfilled of the forbidden. I try not to look, not to smell. She greeted me politely enough. I saw her more clearly now. Long black hair twisted back into a knot, eyes so dark they seem pupilless. Her eyebrows are perfectly straight, giving her a stern look, belied by the comic twist to her mouth. Hands square and functional, nails clipped short. She wears no makeup, and yet there is something slightly indecent about that face. Perhaps it is the directness of her look, the way her eyes linger appraisingly, that permanent crease of irony about the mouth. And she is tall, too tall for a woman, my own height. She stares at me eye to eye, with thrown-back shoulders and defiant chin. She wears a long, flared, flame-coloured skirt and a tight black sweater. This colouring looks dangerous, like a snake or a stinging insect, a warning to enemies. And she is my enemy. I feel it immediately. I sense her hostility and the suspicion, though her voice remains low-pitched and pleasant throughout. I feel she has lured me here to taunt me, that she knows some secret that even I... But this is nonsense. What can she know? What can she do? It is merely my sense of order which is offended, as a conscientious gardener might take offence at a patch of seeding dandelions. The seed of discord is everywhere, mon père, and it spreads... It spreads. I know. I am losing my perspective. But we must be vigilant all the same, you and I. Remember Les Marauds and the gypsies we ousted from the banks of the Tarn? Remember how long it took, how many fruitless months of complaints and letter-writing until we took the matters into our own hands? Remember the sermons I preached? Door after door was closed against them. Some shopkeepers cooperated at once. They remembered the gypsies from the last time, and the sickness, the thieving, and the whoring. They were on our side. I recall we had to pressure Narcisse, who typically would have offered them summer employment in his fields. But at last we uprooted them all, the sullen men and their bold-eyed slatterns, their foul-mouthed, barefooted children, their scrawny dogs. They left, and volunteers cleaned up the filth they left behind them. A single dandelion seed, mon père, would be enough to bring them back. You know that as well as I. And if she is that seed... I spoke to Jolene Drew yesterday. Anouk Rocher has joined the primary school. A pert child, black hair like her mother's, and a bright, insolent smile. Apparently Jolene found her son Jean, among others, playing some kind of game with the child in the schoolyard. A corrupting influence, I gather. Divination or some such nonsense. Bones and beads in a bag scattered in the dirt. I told you I knew their kind. Jolene has forbidden Jean to play with her again, but the lad has a stubborn streak in him and turns sullen. At that age, nothing answers but the strictest discipline. I offered to give the boy a talking to myself, but the mother won't agree. That's what they're like, mon père. Weak. Weak. I wonder how many of them have already broken their Lenten vows. I wonder how many ever intended to keep them. For myself, I feel that fasting cleanses me. The sight of the butcher's window appalls. Scents are heightened to a point of intensity that makes my head reel. Suddenly the morning odour of baking from Poitou's is more than I can bear. The smell of hot fat from the rôtisserie in the Place des Beaux-Arts, a shaft from hell. I myself have touched neither meat, nor fish, nor eggs for over a week, subsisting on bread, soups, salads, and a single glass of wine on Sunday, and I am cleansed, père, cleansed. I only wish I could do more. This is not suffering. This is not penance. I sometimes feel that if I could only show them the right example, if it could be me on that cross, bleeding, suffering. That witch Voisin mocks me as she goes by with her basket of groceries. Alone in that family of good churchgoers, she scorns the church, grinning at me as she hobbles past, her straw hat tied around her head with a red scarf and her stick wrapping the flags at her feet. I bear with her only because of her age, mon père, and the pleas of her family. Stubbornly denying treatment, denying comfort, she thinks she'll live forever. But she'll break one day. They always do. And I'll give her absolution in all humility. I'll grieve in spite of her many aberrations, her pride and her defiance. I'll have her in the end, mon père. In the end, won't I have them all? Thursday, February the 20th. I was waiting for her. Tartan coat, hair scraped back in an unflattering style, hands deft and nervous as a gunslinger's. Josephine Muska, the lady from the carnival. She waited until my regulars, Guillaume, Georges and Narcisse, had left before she came in, hands thrust deeply into her pockets. "Hot chocolate, please." She sat down uncomfortably at the counter, speaking down into the empty glasses I had not yet had time to clear. "Of course." I did not ask her how she liked her drink, but brought it to her with chocolate curls and chantilly, decorated with two coffee creams at the side. For a moment she looked at the glass with narrowed eyes, then she touched it tentatively. "The other day," she said with forced casualness, "I forgot to pay for something." She has long fingers, oddly delicate in spite of the calluses on the fingertips. In repose, her face seems to lose some of its dismayed expression, becoming almost attractive. Her hair is a soft brown, her eyes golden. "I'm sorry." She threw the 10-franc piece onto the counter with a kind of defiance. That's okay. I made my voice casual, disinterested. It happens all the time. Josephine looked at me for a second suspiciously, then, sensing no malice, relaxed a little. This is good. Sipping the chocolate. Really good. I make it myself, I explained, from the chocolate liquor, before the fat is added to make it solidify. This is exactly how the Aztecs drank chocolate centuries ago. She shot me another quick, suspicious glance. Thank you for the present, she said at last. Chocolate almonds, my favourite. Then, quickly, the words rushing out of her in desperate, ungainly haste. I never took it on purpose. They'll have spoken about me, I know, but I don't steal. It's them. Contemptuous now, her mouth turned down in rage and self-hatred. The Clermont bitch and her cronies, liars. She looked at me again, almost defiantly. I heard you don't go to church. Her voice was brittle, too loud for the small room and the two of us. I smiled. That's right. I don't. You won't last long here if you don't, said Josephine, in the same high, glassy voice. They'll have you out of here the way they do everyone they don't approve of. You'll see. All this. A vague, jerking gesture at the shelves, the boxes, the display window with its pièce montée. None of this will help you. I've heard them talking. I've heard the things they say. So have I. I poured myself a cup of chocolate from the silver pot, small and black like espresso, with a chocolate spoon to stir it. My voice was gentle. But I don't have to listen. A pause while I sipped. And neither do you. Josephine laughed. The silence revolved between us. 5 seconds. 10. They say you're a witch. That word again. She lifted her head defiantly. Are you? I shrugged, drank. Who says? Jolene Drew? Caroline Clermont? Curé Renaud's Bible groupies? I heard them talking outside Saint-Jérôme's. Your daughter was telling the other children something about spirits. There was curiosity in her voice, and an underlying reluctant hostility I did not understand. Spirits! She hooted. I traced the dim outline of a spiral against the yellow mouth of my cup. I thought you didn't care what those people had to say. I'm curious. That defiance again. Like a fear of being liked. Josephine said, You were talking to Armand the other day. No one talks to Armand, except me. Armand Voisin, the old lady from Les Marauds. I like her, I said simply. Why shouldn't I talk to her? Josephine clenched her fists against the counter. She seemed agitated, her voice cracking like frostbitten glass. Because she's mad, that's why. She waved her fingers at her temple in a vague, indicative gesture. Mad, mad, mad. She lowered her voice for a moment. I'll tell you something, she said. There's a line across Lansquenet, demonstrating on the counter with a calloused finger. And if you cross it, if you don't go to confession, if you don't respect your husband, if you don't cook 3 meals a day and sit by the fire thinking decent thoughts and waiting for him to come home, if you don't have children, and you don't bring flowers to your friends' funerals or vacuum the parlour or dig the flower beds. She was red-faced with the effort of speaking. Her rage was intense, enormous. Then you're crazy, she spat. You're crazy, you're abnormal, and people talk about you behind your back and... She broke off, the agonised expression slipping from her face. I could see her looking beyond me through the window, but the reflection against the glass was enough to obscure what she might be seeing. It was as if a shutter had descended over her features, blank and sly and hopeless. Sorry, I got carried away for a moment. She swallowed a last mouthful of chocolate. I shouldn't talk to you. You shouldn't talk to me. It's going to be bad enough already. Is that what Armand says? I ask gently. I have to go. Her clenched fists dug into her breastbone again in the recriminatory gesture which seemed so characteristic of her. I have to go. The look of dismay was back on her face, her mouth turning downwards in a panicked rictus so that she looked almost dull-witted. And yet the angry, tormented woman who had spoken to me a moment ago was far from that. What, whom had she seen to make her react in that way? As she left La Praline, head pushed down into an imaginary blizzard, I moved to the window to watch her. No one approached her. No one seemed to be looking in her direction. It was then that I noticed Renaud, standing by the arch of the church door. Renaud and a balding man I did not recognize. Both were staring fixedly at the window of La Praline. Renaud? Could he be the source of her fear? I felt a prick of annoyance at the thought that he might be the one who had warned Josephine against me. And yet she had seemed scornful, not afraid, when she mentioned him earlier. The second man was short but powerful. Checked shirt rolled up over shiny red forearms. Small intellectual's glasses, oddly at variance with the thick, fleshy features. A look of unfocused hostility hung about him, and at last I realized I had seen him before. In a white beard and red robe, flinging sweets into the crowd. At the carnival. Santa Claus throwing bonbons to the crowd as if he hoped he might take out someone's eye. At that moment a group of children came up to the window, and I was unable to see more. But I thought I knew now why Josephine had fled in such haste.